Our speaker this afternoon is quite a gentleman. I met Uncle Fred in Savannah just a short time ago, and I watched him kind of referee a little meeting that they had down in Savannah. Now, this is not to imply that they have any problems with their AA down there, but Uncle Fred very calmly and with his hands in his pocket, saw fit that there was no blood drawn or any of the kind. He did a very fine job. I've just been told that I'm going to introduce him to you people as Uncle Fred Buttermilk Nose N. Uncle Fred, you'll tell us what it's all about, please.
Hallelujah. Is everybody happy? Isn't it wonderful to be sober? I am Fred McLennan, member of the Hostess City Group in Savannah, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Fred.
I've been around, excuse me, I'm just about to take the flu, looks, but I'm going to try to battle it through here. I've been around for quite a while. It's obvious that I was around quite a while before I got around. I've used that hallelujah as a trademark for a long time. It's an expression of thanksgiving, and every day I live is another Thanksgiving day. I feel great and honored to come up today to speak of Virgil's birthday. 13 years ago today, I was sitting in the DeSoto Hotel babysitting him. I didn't have anything to do with his sobriety or nothing, whatever. But I think that sometime during that period, God gave him the gift to want to be sober, and he accepted it. I see a lot of people here this afternoon, and I've known some of them for many, many years, and I'm very happy to be back in Atlanta again. I started out as a teenager and wound up as an old man. I was just a country boy who got on the wrong road early. I never saw a woman's needle. I was 15 years old. And now even a knock-kneed and bow-leg don't try to hide them. Times have changed. You'll find out I'm no speaker whatsoever. I don't know why. Just as I've enduring grand friendship is the only reason he invited me up here. I'm quite sure of that. But I'm going to do the best I can. How, when, where, and how, why I became an alcoholic is a useless afterthought or no concern. I did, and I am. I guess that I came from a good family. Everybody else says they did. I was blessed with four sisters and four brothers. And I was a cute baby boy. And they left it up to me to be the jackass of the generation. And I played that role for precision and dedication for 40 years. I'm bewildered I'm standing here alive today. I can't think but any one thing that passes through my mind occasionally. And God left me as an example of his mercy and his forgiveness. And I might be some value to my community and to be help to my fellow man. I have no other reason to believe that, except to believe that that's the reason I am alive. The best definition I ever heard of an alcoholic is being a man with, or a woman, let me put it, with both feet firmly planted in midair. That sounds ridiculous to you, maybe, but don't to me, because I've been that alcoholic all but whirling round and round and round for years and years and years. And I wasn't a fit human person to rejoin the community of human beings until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was kind of a milk toast drunk, you know. I want to put my arm around somebody, a female preferred, and sing Sweet Adeline down by the old mill stream. And even so, I could have been killed a couple of times because I had my arm around the wrong person. I want to say right now, this program will work if you want it bad enough. There's no question about it. I'm not going to take anybody's inventory, but I'm going to give you a comparison myself. And a lot of people that I hear in AA, they're all sincere, fine. There's nothing about it whatsoever is argumentative. It's just a difference in people. We're all just as different as our fingerprints, and there's no question about that. A lot of them come in and they make a talk, or several, and they say the runner ran around with older people. I don't know whether that's an implication that that's what started them on this alcoholic highway or not. I never did run around with older people. I only run around with some young chickadees that I could influence. Didn't have any luck. I don't run around with older people now. They can't even run, much less run around. Some of these people say they come in, and I glory in them. They never lost a wife, never lost a job, never was in jail. I suffered all these things. I don't envy them. I glory in their good fortune. Always. And then some of these things come in. I get a kick out of some of them, but I mean it's a pleasant kick. Because to me, anyone who adopts this program and stays sober, they are right regardless of their interpretation or their opinion. I don't have nothing to argue with any one of them. I get a kick out of these people that they talk about they had so much fun drinking. I went through all those years like the rest of them. I heard a man make a talk just recently. And he had fun right up to the day he lost $15,000 a job. I don't think that's very funny. To me, it was the alcohol having the fun. And when I got a belly full of that alcohol fun, I just discovered that I had destroyed what might have been a productive, profitable, and a happy life. So the fun don't mean anything to me. Some of them come in too. I get a kick out of this, saying they like what it did to them and for them. We've all heard that, a lot of them. I don't like a thing that alcohol ever did to me or for me. Nothing. In the first place, it made an egotistical, arrogant, blab-mouthed, false alarm out of me. Did some of you the same way, I imagine. And in the end, it made a low-down, stinking, rotten, lying, no-good drunk. Who could like that? Not me. There were only 9 grades in school back in my young days. Didn't have any high schools. It didn't take as long to produce a dumbbell then as it does now. As soon as I had finished school, I went to work for a newspaper, and I spent my entire life in the newspaper work. I was intrigued by it. I thought a lot of it, and still do. By the New York Tonight, I'd be up in New York Times office, just going all over the place. I went from the basement to the attic. At 22, I had a very responsible job with the newspaper. 23, I married a very beautiful girl. Same year, I offered a better job, moved to Florida. We met all the snobs and blue noses down there and ran around with them. Parties every weekend, this and that and the other. No whiskey involved. Oh, you know what I mean, drink or two, something or other. Whole time I was down there, I never lost a day's work, never was late. That was before the boom, shortly before, and I went to real estate business with an associate. Well, I gave my wife a new automobile for Christmas. And in May, I borrowed it to make a trip to Miami. I told her I was going down there on a real estate deal, you know. Tell them anything. Told her I'd be back Tuesday afternoon. I was officially scoring a baseball league down there for the newspaper. Well, I went to Miami and I came back 7 weeks later. We didn't have any lighters on the cars. Use old wood matches, and I had my hands up like this. All open cars. You wouldn't see one sedan in the next 25 or 50 cars. It's all open cars back in those days. That's over 50 years ago, you know. Long time. I had my hands up in front of my hand. Hit a rock or something, went in the pine tree. I like to bled to death, actually. Well, when I got back home, still had one of my arms and was slain, the war started. Some man had run into the abutment of a bridge over that little river and threw three women in the creek and didn't hurt them, just doused them good. He was in the paper, but he didn't use his name. And when I got back home, that was you. I says, how in the world could it be me that picked me up and put me in the hospital for 7 weeks? I'd like to bled to death. Yeah, you a newspaper man, you got them to keep it out. And that war's still going on, I guess. That's 52 years ago. She made up her mind to leave, and she did. I haven't got time to go into details. It's rather funny to some people and serious to others, but I lost it. All right? As I said, the only time I ever got drunk that I can remember during my married life was Armistice Day in 1918. Anybody didn't get drunk that day don't come from a good family either. But I sensed the fact that it was all over. My friends and nobody down there even knew it, I don't think. I sensed the fact it was all over. I went to a club to which I belonged, started to drinking, gambling. Didn't drink too much. I don't think I ever went out of that drunk. And I drank up my job. I drank up my Anderson Real Estate Company. I drank up my car. I drank up her wreck. And the little money that we started to save to have a home someday. And in 6 months, I had to borrow $50 to leave there. I don't think I could have done that except I introduced him to the girl he married. So I came up to Savannah. Had a brother in business there at the time. I didn't say anything to them. They didn't say much to me either. But while I was there, I met a business manager of a show company, and he asked me, how would I like to be a press agent in the show business? It intrigued me, but I didn't let him know it. I said, you make me the best proposition, I'll let you know. And he did, and I thought it was fabulous. That expense account, you know, is what tickled me. So I accepted the job. And for 7 years, I did well. I made a tremendous reputation, I'm quite sure of that. The Billboard, the show business magazine, the Billboard in Cincinnati, had an opening for a department editor. They gave it to me, unsolicited. Well, I want you to remember that this progression had already started and getting a little worse all the time. That's the only job I ever had, I think, and I didn't get fired. But I realized the fact that sooner or later they're going to catch me when I start doing these tricks. I'd leave Cincinnati every Friday and come back Sunday night as a rule. That they would fire me, and I didn't want my reputation damaged, you know. So I went down and resigned. I went from that to Variety magazine in New York. And that didn't last long enough to talk about. I didn't like liquor at all. And by this time, I was drinking every day a certain amount. At what time I became an alcoholic, I'm just not positive, certainly not. But I had a great tolerance for liquor. I could drink it, just drink it, and I didn't get away with it. But when I overtaxed that tolerance, I destroyed it, and I became a slave to alcohol. No question about it at all. I'm not going to tell you too much about my drinking career, because I'm interested in my restoration. That's what I'm interested in. But I tell you one thing. One time I was serving as a dual job, press agent and secretary of treasury in one of the biggest jails in this country. We were in Rochester, New York. It was just before repeal, and they had opened up saloons, getting them ready and selling any kind of junk that you can think of. I was walking down the street one day with a bag of $1,000 in my pocket in it to pay the railroad company to move our show train from Rochester to Buffalo. Met three of the showmen, I guess three or four. And I said, come on in, boys, and let's have a drink. I think there's a pool room and bar already set up. We ordered a drink and pulled out about, looked at me like about 3 ounces of some yellowish mess. And it was a job to get it down. Got it down. They all directed their attention to the pool tables or slot machines or something or other. I stood around about 15 minutes. I began to feel a little funny. I said, come on, boy, let's have another drink. I've got to go. All of them refused. Said, no, I don't know. I should have had sense enough, too. I said, give me another drink. And I wallowed it down. It was all right. Give me a Coke or a water or something. I held on to it. Well, it was in August. I don't know how long I stood there. Of course, you know, a few minutes or something. And I walked out in that warm air on the sidewalk and fell unconscious on the sidewalk. I woke up at 1 a.m. the next morning. They just removed the stomach pump. I just regained consciousness. I never will forget him. Dr. Alexander, his chief of staff at that hospital, came down to my room, and my boss was with it. He said, let me tell you something, young man. And I was young then. You better be careful what you drink. There's another spoonful of that stuff. You never made it to this hospital, so you was one of the toughest cases we've ever had here. I swore, you know, that's it. No more. Done. Now. And he said, if you're going to have to drink something, says, get a prescription. There would be some prescription up there at that time. Well, I quit. It lasted about 48 or 72 hours. Back again. Reminded me of a story I heard about scaring an alcoholic. You are not going to scare. You couldn't scare me, and I doubt if you can scare anybody else. Man and his family lived on a little hillside and down the valley of a little creek, a branch, and on the other side of three, four little old country stores. And he would leave home every Friday afternoon, go down, cross over to the store and come back drunk every Saturday night, just regular. Neighbors were all concerned and they tried to counsel the family, and one day a man said, let's try to scare him. How you going to do it? He said, one of you ladies make me a full-length robe and a hood. I'll go down and get behind a tree and wait till he comes by Saturday night, and when I get him between me and home, I'll try to scare the life out of him. Saturday came, he went down, planted himself behind the tree, and it wasn't long before he heard this drunk coming down the hill. Sweet Adeline. So we waited, he got by, and he came out behind him, and he says, halt. The drunk turned around and says, who are you? He shouts to storm, he says, I am the devil. He said, well, what do you know? I've been wanting to meet you. I married your sister. I don't think that you can scare alcohol like I couldn't out of me. If being confined would have cured me, I'd have been well 15 years before I came to AA, before I found AA, let me see. What we need is sympathetic understanding, and in AA we have it. We can understand your problem from the beginning. I don't care what it is. When you walk in that door, you don't have to open your mouth, and we know a lot about you to start with. And you know a lot about us, too. I woke up in Asheville one morning. Never forget this. We're all the smart addicts. I was sane, you know, never no insanity attached to my drinking. Woke up in Asheville one morning, and I could tell by the vibrations of the bed there's somebody in there with me. I was staring at the ceiling and shaking and sick, and I finally had nerve enough to look around, and there she was. I said, "What happened?" She says, "Darling, don't you know we was married at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon?" Darling didn't know a damn thing about it. I lost my hat and I jumped up and I said, "Where's the whiskey?" She said, "You drank it all last night." I said, "Just stay in till I get back." Went down and got a cab. Western North Carolina was dry then. I found it all right. And paid $7.50 for a bottle of liquor and $2.50 for a hat. You know, we smart business people. Anyway, I went back up there. Now, I didn't pick this woman up off the street. I met her and her young couple that was going to get married at the courthouse in another city. And they asked me to go along with them. I'd known them several years as legal secretary. And I, you know, that stirred me up something. I knew her daddy, too, and I was scared of him. So anyway, she decided she'd go back to talk it over with her father. I said, "If you, that's what you want to do, it's all right." I could have took care of a woman. The show I represented at that time was in Illinois. It headed east. I had a lot of business to do up all over North Carolina. Anyway, I said, "I'll be in Charlotte next Tuesday night. You call me and let me know what you want to do, or come, either one. I'm willing to try to make a go of it." And I meant it. I never did hear from her. 5 months later, I got a lawyer, got a letter, some papers from the lawyer she worked for to institute an annulment proceedings, and it went through. She's married, got a nice home, got some children, all. I checked on her for several years. Not direct, but through other people there. I was deeply, essentially, sense of deep obligation there, I'm telling you. Well, you see, the point I'm making is we are fast workers. There is a courtship, a marriage, a honeymoon, and a separation in 27 hours. She went back home the next night. Well, I'm about through with this drinking business, I think. I tell you something, though, this is cute, I think. To me, it is. I broke even twice drinking alcohol. I accumulated enough money 2 different times to go in business. And I drank enough money 2 different times to go out of business. Drank enough whiskey, I should have said. One of them, incidentally, was an Atlanta druggist. Place up on Peachtree, nice drugstore. And you know, I drank him down to his last bottle of M.O. and a tube of Preparation H. I put him out of business. He helped some, but he never became an alcoholic. He's a successful businessman down in Florida now. But one other instance, you know, when I was in that show business, I met every kind of people, all kinds of people, freaks, sermonologists, astrologists, hypnotists, mentalists, magicians, fortune tellers. We were playing in Detroit, Michigan State Fair, and a little gal come in one morning, a little gypsy gal, to pay a privilege for operating a booth. I don't know whether I winked at her or not. Must have something. I don't know what happened, but anyway, she paid it. And when she left, she said, "I'd like to tell you a fortune someday." I said, "I'll be down when I have an opportunity and let you do it." I never had a fortune told, and never will again more either. So one day I had taken a couple of drinks. I had a fishing assistant in the office, and I said, "I'm going down and let that little gal tell my fortune." So I started down the street, having the fortune told down in Midway, and I was thinking she's going to tell me I'll be the chairman of the board, I'll be president of some big corporation, or I'll eventually wind up as a millionaire, you know. So I walked up and I said, "Come on in and tell my fortune." We went and sat down and she said, "Let me see your hand." I'm left-handed, so I put my left hand out there. She looked at it a couple of seconds. I see a shaky head. I just begin to come down already over the cloud, you know. Said, "Let me see your other hand." Same sign. She looked up at me and she said, "Mr. Mack, I read in your hands you're going to have a lot of trouble and hard luck until you are 50. Boy, that was sad. Ooh. I got up enough nerve and I says, "What about after 50? She said, "You'll be used to it by then." That was about 1935, just about the same year that the alcoholic program was given to us suffering alcoholics. And that little gal couldn't see in a crystal ball that someday I would find something that would turn me around in my tracks and change the whole world around me. Well, I was up in Massachusetts and I got a letter from my mother. She was still living. I said, "I'm going to Georgia." Went in and resigned the job, which I had lost my capabilities. I could just make a living, that was all. And I'd made a lot of money in the show business, a lot of it. But I was down then. I came to Georgia, not ashamed to go to Savannah. I'd get sober. I had reached this stage now that I could work anywhere in a newspaper. I was more than 6 or 8 weeks. I had me a circuit, Charleston, Macon, Atlanta, Birmingham, Montgomery, Columbus, Jacksonville, back to Savannah. I had a lifelong friend in Savannah in the newspaper, and he always put me back to work. It looked like I was sober. So I made that circuit just regular as a clock. Excuse me, I look like I'm going to get the flu in spite of myself. You see, by this time I could no longer think except evil. I could not longer live with myself. I had become a faithless, hopeless, lonesome, loveless, miserable wreck. I had consigned myself to a drunkard's grave. I had cancer of the soul. Then one day something did happen. I'd been there about 5 or 6 weeks, and I expected to get fired again for the soon drinking, but heavy every day. Man came up from Miami to work for the Morning News. He'd worked for newspapers all over the country, some of them I had, and others I'd visited as a press agent, and we became quite friendly. Went out to lunch about a week later, and we walked back in the office. We were standing there. He was tall, broad-shouldered, dignified. I could never connect him with alcohol, ever. And we were standing there talking about some newspaper episode somewhere or another. And he said to me, he said, "You know where Alcoholics Anonymous is located?" I said, "No, Jim, I don't." Pointed the phone directory. I said, "Why don't you look in that directory? Maybe they're listening." And as he turned around to go pick up that directory, he said, "That's the only way I've ever been able to stay sober." I didn't pay attention to him. Went back and had a drink and chewed up some coffee beans and maybe had a cube or two of Sin Sin. They thought I was the vice president of Sin Sin Company. Didn't pay any attention to it, and about, I guess it was a week or 10 days, I don't remember exactly. I had my day off in the middle of the week. Stopped at an apartment house and bought a half a pint of liquor. Went back to the men's room, opened it, and drank about a third of it. And before I got back to the door, the compulsion had hit me. I went in and bought a whole armful. Went home, and that was the worst drink that I was drunk that I ever was. Ten times worse than any I'd ever been on. Lasted 3 weeks. First week I ate very good. Second week about half. Third week nothing. My sister'd come in. She was my keeper. Bless her heart, she's still living, 92. She'd come in and say, "Fred, can I fix you something to eat?" I'd say, "No, Mary, I'll be all right. It's going to be all right. It's going to be all right." So it wobbled on terrible. She came in this afternoon. She said, "Fred, you can't live like this." And Fred knew it. I was just as near dead as I'll ever be until I do die. Said, "Let me call the doctor." And I said, "Go ahead and call him." His office is about 2 blocks from my home, so I don't know how much time left, but I wobbled and got up and wobbled up the hall to the entrance for you, and just as I did, the bell rang, and I raised up one of the slats and a big light out in front of it. There was the doctor. I said, come in, Doctor. I'm going to tell you something. He walked over and set a little instrument satchel down, and I set across the table for him, and I told him, 38 years of drinking in less than 10 minutes. And I said, now I want you to do something for me. He just reached down and got a little bag, come over to me and pointed his finger in my face, and he said, Fred, the best thing I can do for you, you're going to have to do it yourself. You could have heard me cuss him from here to that big building over there, whatever it is. My sister came running up and said, what's the matter? I said, I'll let you know later. What did he do for you? I said, tell you that too. She led me back to the room, bedroom, says, if you need me, call me. Well, I already reached a point I couldn't swallow any whiskey. It'd come back, you know, and boy, it don't taste the same coming back. And boy, that's good. And I'd take a swallow of water. Bleh. Awful. So, I had to have a drink. I pulled some out in an ashtray with cigarette butts and ashes and all. Here I'm sitting down. Don't ever try to take a drink like that. All I wound up with was a mouthful of ashes. Well, you can believe it or not, I sit there and I begin to wonder about this thing. I love that step four. God, I love it. It's the first time in my life I ever knew anything about Fred McClendon. Not completed, just in generalities. Well, along about, oh, it must have been near midnight, I don't remember, of course. I had a bilious attack. Gas. Boy, I was generating gas faster than I could belt. Blah, 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 blah. Sounded like I was playing a bass fiddle in a hippie orchestra. I knew it was going to stop my heart. I knew that was it. Pressure was terrific. And I didn't care, just to be honest with you. So I went out and crawled out in the kitchen, got a hold of the sink, and pulled myself up, still playing the fiddle. My sister came out. She said, Fred, you awfully sick, aren't you? I said, no, Mary, I'm not sick. I'm dying. She says, well, I eat some highly seasoned food occasionally, and I drink some hot water, and I get some relief. Will you try that? I said, I'll try anything. She led me over to the kitchen table and put a little boil on, and within minutes, there's the hot water. I didn't think I could swallow it, but I could. That's just where the turning point in my life came, I presume. I just sit there and drank 2-3 cups, and I did get some relief, not complete. And I went back in my room, and I continued that inventory. Finally, I hadn't had any connection with a higher power or anything else for 25 or 30 years. Didn't know what they did in church or anything else. I had some spiritual values in my childhood, of course. And I didn't get down on my knees, because I don't think the position of your body's got anything to do with it. You got the sincerity in here. I said, God, if there's a way out, show me. And if there isn't, take me. I don't want to live another day like this. And you know the first thing that happened to me? Give a mark. A man made up in the morning news in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only way he could ever be say so. And I said, if you let me live till tomorrow morning, I'll find out. Where the strength came from, I'll never know. I got up and I bathed and shaved and went out in the kitchen, told my sister was hungry, and she made me a milk punch and this and that and the other. And I said, Mary, I'm going out. Oh, Fred, you can't go out. I said, you love to fall and hurt yourself. She knew my condition. I said, I'm going because I heard a man say I was able to stay sober. And I'm going to make it. He only lived a couple blocks away in the apartment. I went over, woke him up. Came to the door, says, hello there, Mac. I thought you'd left town. He hadn't seen me about a month, you know. I said, Jim, I came over here to get you to take me to that place I heard you mention up there one day tomorrow noon. He said, where? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you have a problem, too? I said, yeah, 38 or 40 years is one. I have it. He jumped out of the bed and he took me to AA. Walked in there. Four or five, I had a custodian there, and there's four or five men there. I thought there was one of them going to be in this afternoon, but he had to go back, I guess, or something or other. They didn't ask me how many wives I drank up, how much money I owed, how many jails I'd been in, anything else. Started telling me some of their own experience, and they thought they could help me if I wanted to be helped. I was shaking like a leaf. I could have joined any hula show in the country if I had a grass skirt. And one of these men said to me, he became a marvelous friend of mine since then. He passed on 3-4 years ago. He looked at me and said, "What you need is a drink." I said, "Yes, that's what I've always used, but I'm not going to take one." He said, "You think you can go to this town tomorrow without taking a drink?" I convicted myself. I said, "Anybody could do that." He said, "If you can, you can go the rest of your life one day at a time without a drink of liquor." I've never heard anything any true. Never in my life. Simple. Anyway, what did I find in Alcoholics Anonymous? A huge tank of the milk of human kindness, tinctured with fellowship, brotherly love, and sympathetic understanding. And I was thirsty, oh God, I was thirsty, and I drank of it, and I drank of it, and I drank of it. And that's the kind of drinking that made me well. I've had a spiritual awakening, let me see. Guess what, I don't know, but as the increase of happiness came to me, it was months and months, I presume, after. But I kept feeling that I was getting happier and better, living better, feeling better. And when that happiness became complete, that must have been when it was. Because I've been happy every day since. I don't meet people as any happier as could be than I am. I had spiritual seeds planted in me as a child and in my formative years. I thought they were destroyed years before, but they were not, just submerged with alcohol. And when that alcohol began to evaporate and I gained some sense of feeling and values, those seeds began to germinate and to grow and to bloom into the most beautiful thing in my life, sobriety. This program has to hollow out our hearts so that love and beauty and happiness can come in. We can't have those things along with filled up with resentments, self-pity, and guilt. But I'll tell you, in that proper application, an honest, proper application of these 12 steps, we'll do that for you, us, and we can have all of those things. The glory of AA to me, and the strongest and deepest reasons for our success lies in our insistence on the spiritual growth of the alcoholic. We don't chart creeds, but we do suggest over and over you find your own chart, your own pathway to God as you will understand it. We don't have... Let me tell you, the most beautiful story I ever watched on TV was based on the 11th commandment. John 14:34 reads, "I give unto you a new commandment, that you love one another. As I have loved ye, so shall ye love one another." Now if that commandment had been universally observed, we wouldn't have a lot of these wars that has slaughtered millions. The war with alcohol began with the beginning of man, I'm quite sure, and it's been going on. It's raging, it's furious, and it seems to me like it's getting worse. We all did our stint. How deeply graceful can we be that God separated us from that army and let us become victorious? I hope I never see a re-enlistment. Oh, I got another hour here. I'm going to tell you something. We don't have any medicine to give anybody, any pharmaceutical capsules or pills or liquid. We understand that physical rehabilitation is important, and some of them have to go to the hospital and get over it. I did myself. But we do have some powerful medicine here. It's God's medicine. And if you can take it, you'll get well, and there isn't any question about it. That's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a friend of mine sitting here now, and I don't know why I can repeat it exactly as it was. He sent me a beautiful letter. He came through Savannah and he didn't get a chance to see me. He got back home and wrote me a letter. And here's the substance of it. He said, "I want to forever remain green so I can continue to grow. I don't want to get like a Georgia peach and fall to the ground and begin to rot. And that too can happen to me unless I keep this program at a high level of enthusiasm throughout my days in life." Isn't that beautiful? That's me. I want to stay green. I'm not fixing to cry. I'm just fixing to cloud up my throat here. Hey, now, I have something here I want to share with you. I don't know where I picked it up, somewhere. It says, "We live when we are true to ourselves, authentic in our feelings, responsive to our convictions. We live when we love, when we are committed and concerned in the lives of others. We live when we build and create hope, suffer, and rejoice. Treasure life in yourself and you give it to others. Give it to others and it will come back to you. For life, like love, cannot thrive in its own threshold, but is renewed as it offers itself." I think I've talked long enough. I could stand here a month and tell you the beautiful things that's come to me. Nothing but good, always good. I've lived a happy, comfortable life ever since the day I got sober. And it's offered to anyone, anywhere. When I saw you people all assembling in here, on the street or wherever I see you, I think of Edgar Guest's poem. It's titled "Sermons We See." It begins, "I'd rather see a sermon than to hear one any day. I'd rather you should walk with me than merely show the way." When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people just like you reached down and took my hand and lifted me out of a pit of desperation and taught me how to live. And I've been walking with you every day since. And I want to walk with you down the last mile. I'm going to tell you a story now. It's very beautiful. About a man and his wife going to celebrate the golden wedding anniversary. Life had been good to them. They never, materially, they never had a want. Outside of a little impairment to her hearing, their health had been good throughout. So the day came, and the relations and friends and neighbors came by the score with gifts and well wishes. And every evening when the last of the guests departed, they sat in the living room, gazing into the embers, living those 50 years over again in retrospect. A little silence. And he looked across at his wife and he said, "I'm proud of you." She said, "Did you say something, John?" He said, "Yes, I said I was proud of you." She said a little loud, I didn't quite understand. "I said I was proud of you." She said, "Yes, and I'm getting tired of you too." I want to leave you with this. At our convention here in Atlanta in 1956, there was a Chicago lawyer who spoke on Saturday night. I forget his name now. And somewhere during that talk, he said that no AA recovering alcoholic should ever forget the gift that God gave him, the gift to want to be sober. Well, that's about all I took back to Savannah with me. I knew I'd been sober several years. I knew he'd given me that gift, but I'd never given it the significance it deserved, and I've cherished it every day since. With that gift, he gave me a responsibility and a reward. Excuse me, please. The responsibility I feel was I should try to help some suffering, poor, downtrodden human being get off of that horrible and crippling alcoholic highway, the same one that I had come down through all those years. And I have tried. The reward stems from the fact that I had made considerable progress in Alcoholics Anonymous before I lost my mother. God bless her. What greater gift can I give to the memory of that dear soul than to carry this torture of sobriety and hold it high the rest of my life? What greater gift can any man or woman give to the parents of their living or to their memory? What greater gift can any man give to his wife or the wife to the husband or each to the other? What greater gift can they give to their children and other loved ones? What greater gift can they give to their friends and to society? Ladies and gentlemen, my book is No Alcoholic on the Face of This Earth will ever have anything 1/1000 as glorious, as beautiful to give to anyone than his or her sobriety. Thank you, I love you, and may God bless all of us.
It is my extreme pleasure to ask Margaret and son Chuck if they'll please come up here. Please, Margaret, come on up and help out. Margaret, Virgil's wife by marriage.
No.
Well, come on, Virgil. Greetings, almost married, don't they?
Feel like confessional up here. We were late. She didn't think we were coming, and we probably disturbed everybody as we came in. This is the 13th anniversary. It's hard to believe that when Daddy came into the program, I was working on my 11th birthday. That's how time flies. But his entrance into the program reminds me of an experience I had last week. I was coming back from the merchandise mart. As you know, I work for Davison's now.
Drumming up business.
As I got to the corner of Peachtree and Kane Street, I saw a man standing there in the nude. And it's all right. Atlanta has changed in 13 years. I asked this gentleman, I said, "Excuse me, what are you doing in that condition?" And he said, "Well, about 4 o'clock this morning, I went to my friend's apartment. As soon as I arrived, the lights went off, and a voice said, 'All right, all men, take your clothes off.' And assuming he knew what he was doing, I took them off. And then the same voice said, 'All right, all women, remove your clothes.' And since it was dark, I had no way of knowing, but I assumed that they did also. And then the voice said, 'All right, let's all go to town. And I guess I'm the first one here.'"
That's her son.
Well, in Daddy's case, it was just backwards. He sent Mama as an emissary to check out the conditions and everything. This went on for some time before he came in and really took the program seriously. Daddy's always been hard-headed in some ways and a little slower to catch on, but he has come into the program. I can say this in public now. He can't bother me. But he did make a success. And for the past 13 years, our family has been going double time to make up a lot of things that we lost during the early parts. A lot of the fellowship and a lot of things that families do, which we never did before, because we were very polarized. The bottle was in the middle, and it was very difficult for us to function as a family. Mother and Daddy and me continue to grow day by day through this program, as do all of y'all out there. It's been a good life for us, and through the grace of God, it will continue for some time to come. It's nice to see a lot of people here. Bish, Fred, who I haven't seen in quite a long time. And at this point, just let me say thanks for another year. And through the grace of God, we'll see you next year, too. I have the chip here, unless you'd like to have that.
That was my baby. No, it's wonderful. This is, I suppose, this 13. If I ever had a superstition, it's been 13 in my life. And nobody could be happier than I am to see this 13 behind me. I'm working on 14 now, not 13. And as to our speaker today, he didn't tell it, but I thought he would. A lot of you people have heard my story. When I had my last drunk in the DeSoto Hotel in Savannah, Georgia, not realizing a lot of telephoning back and forth between Atlanta. And on a Friday night, there was a knock on my door, and I opened it, and there stood Cornel Foy and Uncle Fred. They came in and spent a good portion of that night with me. And then the next day, Fred came back and stayed with me until my eventual sponsor, Russell, came after me. I said this many times before, and I mean it. There may be a lot of things happen in my life. Fred Mike London may do a lot of things that I won't like. But he'll never be able to do anything that'll keep me from loving him. He brought it to me, along with all of you. And thank you and God bless you for being here.
Thank you, Virgil. Happy birthday. I hope I'm here to see many more. Does anyone have anything they would like to say before we close? If not, let's rise and close in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Foreman.